politics has got to feel like a movie. The first thing the president had done when he came in power in 2000 was to seize control of television. It was television through which the Kremlin decided which politicians it would allow as its puppet opposition, what the country's history and fears and consciousnesses should be, and the new Kremlin wouldn't make the same mistake as the old Soviet Union one. They would never let TV become dull. Never let it get boring is a major tactic.
This is so America is pissing me off.
The end of the world is coming fast.
Happy Doomsday, Lauren.
Happy Doomsday, Renfro.
How's your doomsday today?
It's pretty good. I'm wearing a bright shirt, and it's not raining.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's positive.
You?
Good. Actually, I think it's supposed to rain here in Los Angeles, like, tonight or tomorrow. Last week was my birthday, actually.
Happy birthday to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So... I split up my birthday friend plans in half, which I feel like is a new tactic I do these days. I'm like, chill friends, on Wednesday, come with me to a brewery where they're playing some bluegrass and it's very low-key and quiet. And then Friday, I went to see this artist I've wanted to see for a long time named Boblog the Third. And it was
Boblog
really
the Third.
Fun. Yeah.
You know what that makes me think of? Arrested Development, blah, blah, blah.
I know. Yeah. Every friend I told about this said that exact thing. They said, blah, 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 slog, blog. Yeah.
Oh, man. So I'm completely unoriginal. Noted.
Also, he's been around since like 94. So I think he predates blah, blah, blogs, law blog.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. So the chill friends can sit down, have a nice chat, chill over bluegrass. And the not chill friends are in mosh pits.
Kind of. Yeah.
Cool.
It was a good show. It was really fun. He plays kind of like really, he's a one-man band. So he's got like drums and cymbal kits on the ground. And he's got kind of like a twangy slide guitar, like Delta Blues kind of stuff. And he wears this like spaceman helmet. And in the helmet, he has a old telephone. And all of his vocals come through the phone. So it's got this compressed old phone sound.
Oh, wow.
And he's also just like funny and got a weird sense of humor. After every song, he stands up and goes, yeah.
You know, I want to know the history of the one man band. Like, at what point did you decide, like, I don't need other people. I can do this on my own.
He came out of necessity. He had a band and then his bandmates went off and did other things. And he's like, well, I guess I'll just live out of my car for 20 years and be a one man band and travel the country. He plays like 300 shows a year.
Whoa.
It's like a true... small scale rock and roller, just living that life, playing rock shows every single night of the year.
Good for you, one man band.
That's cool. Oh, also, he has this gag where he gets people from the audience to come on the stage and sit on his legs because, you know, it's harder for him to drum that way. So he gets people to come up, and I did it. I went up on stage, sat in his lap. It was good.
Nice. I haven't gone to a live show in way too long.
Well, you want to get into it?
Yeah, we can. It's up to you.
Okay, I guess so. I mean, we're here. We might as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm constantly bracing myself for whatever nightmare that we discuss in a given episode. This particular topic, very intrigued by, don't quite understand it, looking forward to you teaching.
Yeah, we have a weird one today. Today, we are talking about hyper-normalization. And I know what you're thinking, listener. You're thinking... it's a big word for such a small podcast. Well, yeah, it was a big word for me too. And it took a while to get my head around it, but I am here to tell you about it now. So, the term hypernormalization was coined in a book called Everything Was Forever Until It Was No More by a Russian writer and anthropologist. The book describes the paradoxical nature of living under the Soviet Union during the 70s and 80s. The author said that everyone in the Soviet Union knew the system that they were living under was failing, but no one could imagine an alternative to the status quo, so politicians and citizens were resigned to maintaining the pretense of a functioning society. Over time, the mass delusion became a self-fulfilling prophecy, with everyone accepting it as the new norm rather than pretend. This final stage in accepting a clearly fabricated reality as legitimate is what Yerchak terms hyper-normalization.
Wow.
So you're already having flashbacks to
yeah,
things you see in current America, right?
Yeah, things I see in current America. You know, when they always harken back to like, oh, I want to go back to the 50s. That feels peak hyper-normalization in a way that we don't right now, because I think there's enough people who know that it's failing and are not accepting it as it is. Mm-hmm. But in the 50s, they were accepting that shit.
Yeah.
They were deep in it. They were Stepford wifing it.
Yeah, they turned on the TV and saw Leave It to Beaver, and they said, what is this documentary?
Yeah, exactly.
What is this nonfiction filmmaking?
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Okay,
I'm excited. I'm sorry. That intro, like, I'm excited.
Yeah, I really wanted to cover this topic because even though it's kind of a complicated, loose philosophical concept, and it's going to get into some slightly conspiratorial leanings, but I think it's like, once you learn about this term and the way it's applied, you're going to see that it applies to so many of the things we're going to cover in this podcast and so many of the things that you're going to see in the daily news, I think, in our current hellscape. So I think it's a good piece of ammunition to have in your philosophical arsenal.
Yeah. Let's do it. I'm very into this. My brain is bouncing.
Let's get hyper for hyper-normalization. So, in 2016, nearly a decade ago, a filmmaker named Adam Curtis made a documentary film called Hyper-Normalization, applying this concept to the current day and America in particular. And that's where I first heard of this, and that's where most people have first heard of this, is actually this documentary. The central thesis of the documentary is that after the economic crash of the 1970s, those in power basically gave up on the idea of trying to effect direct change in a world that had become impossibly complex and unpredictable, and began instead to promote fake, simplified narratives of world events to guide the world in ways largely beneficial to banks and multinational corporations. The new world sought not to change things, but to simply manage a post-political world. So that's a very heavy and vague saying there, but basically, the world post-70s, the world and geopolitics were so complicated that it became easier to get political objectives accomplished by creating simplified narratives to get public support behind rather than having everyone be a geopolitical expert.
Yeah.
And that sort of devolved, especially as the power structures in American capitalism shift to banks being able to be like really the ones in control.
Yeah, I mean, part of me wonders how complex it actually was versus them wanting simply to control the American population. And not just, I can only speak for America because we're Americans, but I think about the 60s and the 70s and this upheaval of a nation based on what people understood of wars that we were participating in overseas that we thought were unfair, things that were happening domestically that it was unfair. There was so much happening that I almost wonder if it's less about, oh, things are too complicated, so it's easier if we dumb it down, and more about we need to find a way to stop these people from being so loud and so effective in pushing against what we're trying to achieve. Like, yeah. I'm more inclined, because American banks and government is corrupt in every sense of the word. I'm more inclined to believe that it was about shutting people up and taking away the power of the American citizen that wouldn't just comply than it is, oh, things are too complicated, so let's just like simplify.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And we're going to go through a lot of sort of specific historical events and specific examples of this. And I think that the complexity of the world probably first helped give cover to this as a concept, where they could get away with it. Most people are just turning on the nightly news and they just want to learn about something in a small dose. And that does just open a window to being able to set the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And people are, I think, more willing to accept something that doesn't require a large level of research and curiosity and nuance. So
yeah, I have more thoughts, but please continue.
Yeah. So I have set out, this is just from me, my three central tenets of hypernormalization as I saw it from reading these different stories. So I got my three rules for you, three big qualities I've seen.
Okay.
So number one central tenet, strategic simplification of complex issues to easily digestible good guy versus bad guy narratives, which are reductive, intentionally misleading, or fabricated entirely.
Yep.
Number two, and this is actually the thing that's maybe most specific to hypernormalization as a term, gaslighting within a system of kayfabe, which I'll define in a minute if you don't know that word. It's gaslighting with the added quality that the population knows that they're being lied to. Those that are lying know that they know, and then both parties just accept this as normality.
Mm.
That's the tagline of the documentary is, they know you know they're lying,
mm-hmm.
which is the thing. It's like, they're lying, you know they're lying, they know that you know they're lying, but there's no alternative. So that's the world we live in.
Yeah.
Kayfabe. Do you know the term kayfabe?
I do not.
It's one I like to use a lot. Kayfabe is a wrestling term, or it's mostly used in wrestling, and it specifically describes the relationship between the performer and the audience member in professional wrestling. Because wrestlers, you know, the audience knows that the wrestlers are playing characters and mm-hmm. that the results of the matches are scripted. They know it's not real.
And I think some of them don't know it's not real.
I don't think so. I think anyone over the age of six knows it's not real. The audience knows it's not real. The wrestlers know that the audience knows it's not real.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't say that out loud. They play along with it because that's how they engage with it. The fakeness is unspoken, but both parties know and both parties know the other party knows.
Kind of like how we are with Santa.
I guess. Well, the kayfabe for Santa is when you as a kid don't want to stop getting gifts from Santa.
Yeah.
But then your parents know that you know Santa isn't real, but also you haven't said it and they don't want to rock the boat. So you're both playing along with this Santa thing. Maybe that's kayfabe. So that's the second central tenet. Gaslighting, mm-hmm. in which both parties know it's fake. And the third central tenet, a genuine widespread inability to decipher what is real or fake due to an environment of confusion, which effectively immobilizes any reasonable pursuit of change.
Mm.
So it's like you're so entrenched within this fake reality that it's like you don't even know where to start to create change. And then it's just that like wet blanket on top of any action.
Yeah, I hate this.
Yeah.
I'm trying to decipher what feelings and emotions are coming up as you've gone through that last one. I can't put my finger on it, but I hate it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, we'll maybe talk more about it in the conclusion, but I think the antidote to hypernormalization is doing a shit ton of research, and it's a lot of work, but you gotta look for multiple sources and learn your shit because people don't want you to know your shit.
Well, the thing is, that fits with the last tenet where you don't even know where to start with learning about hypernormalization.
Yeah, where do you look? Where's real information?
Yeah.
Yeah, it took me a long time to figure out the structure for this episode because it's this broad concept. So I'm going to walk you through some stories that I hope we can look at as sort of, I mean, they're all real stories, but I hope we can kind of look at them as like parables, kind of useful stories that you can apply to stories that are going to be coming in our near future and help navigate the upcoming world. So
I love a good parable.
First, I got to take you to the land that is the best at hypernormalization, maybe outside North Korea. Maybe that's its own separate thing, but Russia. Mother Russia.
Russia.
You could almost just make this an episode about Russia and it would feel like I was making predictions about America. So I'm going to tell you all about how Russian society works here and some of the scary comparisons will become apparent.
Can we pause for effect? Because you just said, I'm going to describe Russia and you're going to feel like I'm talking about America. Has there ever been a point in American history where we can say that at all? Like, we've been so anti-Russia that it's crazy that that's a sentence. So I needed to pause for effect.
Yeah.
Because when you said that, it blew me back.
I mean, you've seen the recent cabinet meeting with,
you know,
Zelensky. It's almost not becoming a thing where I say like Russia. It's almost sort of just a puppet of Russia.
That ambush is far too fresh, and I'm going to get actively angry on the podcast. So let us continue with hyper-normalization.
Yeah.
Woosah.
Yeah, that one just happened.
Yeah.
So in Russia, they have a entire profession that's referred to as political technologist. Political technologists are basically professional engineers of political manipulation. And there's not like a secret, this is not a conspiracy theory. They're like public-facing, well-respected professionals.
Well-respected.
It's considered like a reputable job.
Okay.
20 years after Russia fell apart, after the end of communism, political technologists rose up and took control of the media, and they use it to manipulate the electorate on a vast scale and are crucial to Putin's retention of power. Perhaps the most notable political technologist is a guy named, excuse my horrible pronunciation, this won't be the first time in this Russian section, Vladislav Surkov. Actually, I think I got it.
That felt right.
Yeah. I think I got it. Vladislav Surkov. I even jumped off the cliff twice by saying the word twice. Wow. Taking risks today. Quoting Adam Curtis of the Hypernormalization documentary, Surkov came originally from the theater world, and those who have studied his career say that what he did was take avant-garde ideas from the theater and bring them into the heart of politics. Surkov's aim was not just to manipulate people, but to go deeper and play with and undermine their very perception of the world so they were never quite sure what was really happening. Surkov turned Russian politics into a bewildering, constantly changing piece of theater. He used Kremlin money to sponsor all kinds of groups, from mass anti-fascist youth organizations to the very opposite, neo-Nazi skinheads. The liberal human rights groups who then attacked the government. He backed political parties that supported Putin. He backed political parties that opposed Putin. The key thing that Surkov did was he let it be known that he was doing this, which meant that no one was quite sure what was real or what was fake in a modern-day Russia. As one journalist put it, it's a strategy of power that keeps any opposition constantly confused, a ceaseless shape-shifting that is unstoppable because it is indefinable. So that's kind of wild, right?
All the world's a stage, I suppose.
People, like, you always hear on the right, people like, these are paid protesters. This is bad. They're always like, have these conspiratorial accusations that are one layer deep, where it's like, this is just a fake organization. This is just a fake narrative. Where the actual master manipulation is in doing those things and letting people know that you're doing those things, because then anything can be that. And when that's all the communication, when that's all of television, you're done. And I think it's the thing a lot of people don't understand about Russian culture in America. Mm-hmm. Like, you'll see stories where it's like, oh, the fifth guy in a row just fell out of a giant 8-story hospital building and they just sang it to suicide. Do they think we're stupid? They think we're really going to fall for that? No, they know that you know that it's not a suicide. And that's the whole point.
Yeah. This feels a lot like Trump as well.
Absolutely.
Surkov. Is it Surkov or Surkov?
Surkov.
Surkov feels a lot like Trump in that he has made no qualms about, like, no mistake about what he wants to be doing and the things he will say to get it done. He's made no attempt to hide it or to shelter anybody from it.
Uh-huh.
And they keep talking about flooding the zone, the idea of flooding the zone. And that just sounds exactly like what you just described. That he and his army of idiots are just constantly putting out information that everyone has to question. But he started doing that before he was even president. Mm-hmm. That was his MO. And so then by the time he became, what was it, the 45th president, he had already planted the seed to question everything. And I've long said that that's the most dangerous part of his entire existence, is that every single thing is up for question. And I know that that sounds like, oh, shouldn't everything be up for question? There's some things that should just be fundamental baseline understandings. Some things that we're not going to know the absolute truth to, but and as long as the theory is proven for however long it's been proven scientifically or whatever it is, we have a collective understanding that we're accepting that as truth until and unless proven otherwise. And his mechanism of proving otherwise is to just flood the zone with lies, like outright lies, just say whatever you want to say. And then because he's already planted the seed, like, oh, but you have to question everything, then it's like you question him just as much as you question experts, when these two things, these two levels of questioning don't even belong in the same conversation. But that's not that's not his MO. He feels very Surkoff.
Yeah, everything's just getting lost in the same pool because there's so much to sort through. And they come from similar backgrounds. They both come from entertainment. I mean, Surkoff comes from avant-garde theater, so he's probably a little smarter than Trump, who comes from reality TV.
For sure smarter. Like, for sure. I think I'll add this one last thing. I think what's really upsetting me, because I'm trying to get a handle on it, it feels insidious in like such a specifically evil way. But I think what's upsetting me is that it feels like this Surkoff character, or even the concept of someone like him in the world of politics, is just an agent of chaos just for shits and giggles. Like, as if this is just for fun and that people's lives aren't at stake. And
yeah, it's like a game. And you definitely get the sense that he enjoys being this little puppet master of sorts.
Like, was he a successful artist? Because this feels like I wasn't, so let me make something else. This feels very, you know, like Hitler, you failed at this.
I hadn't even thought about that for some reason, but that's like half of the right-wing influencer sphere. Steve Bannon, you know, Steve Bannon tried to write a Broadway musical. Ben Shapiro is a failed screenwriter. They're all failed actors and writers, and they all wanted to be. They're all artists. Sure. They're all Hitler wanting to paint. Yeah, Steve Bannon wrote a musical about the LA riots, a hip-hop musical about the LA riots.
A hip-hop musical about the LA riots from Steve Bannon.
The script is out there. You can see it. It's weird. And
wow.
Yeah.
So you turn to hate.
Yeah, you go, oh, these people don't like my shitty art. Well, let's burn down society. We just find a way in. The way in to be influential, I guess.
I'm starting to spiral.
All right, well, let's keep on circling the drain. The biggest tool Russia has here is its complete control of the television landscape, where these philosophies are employed not just in news, but also in its narrative television and reality TV. From Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. I didn't write down the artist's name. That's the book I reread for this. Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. Really great book, written by a reality television producer who worked for state Russian TV. Politics has got to feel like a movie. The first thing the president had done when he came in power in 2000 was to seize control of television. It was television through which the Kremlin decided which politicians it would allow as its puppet opposition, what the country's history and fears and consciousnesses should be, and the new Kremlin wouldn't make the same mistake as the old Soviet Union one. They would never let TV become dull. Never let it get boring is a major tactic.
This is so America is pissing me off. I think about the
that's what I was saying.
I think
you read
about
all this
the
and you're
trailers.
Like,
yeah. I think about the literal news trailers that you see on CNN, like tonight at such and such, or get a given person's segment of the night, because we have 24-hour news cycle. It's like watching a literal movie trailer for the news. Who died today? You know, like it's insane. It does feel like a movie. I want it to be boring. Go back to being boring.
You know what I love? PBS NewsHour.
Yeah.
Because it's boring.
News. But it's super informative.
It is. And they have things broken out. Here's domestic news. Here's international news. And here's a old guy in Santa Barbara who plays guitar. There's some dumb throwaway one at the end. That's what the news should be. It's just 1 hour a day. And it's kind of boring. Very informative. I want to tell you the story of a specific person whose name I'm going to butcher here. Yana Yakovleva. Shit. I even practice. Yana Yakovleva. Something like that. I'm not a Russian, so I can't do it. But
sounded right to me.
Yana Yakovleva. In a society built on fake narratives supporting corporate and government interests, her story is, from our perspective, a crazy one, but it is a weirdly common story. Hey. So I got this from that book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible.
Great book.
She was the owner of a small company that traded in cleaning chemicals in Russia, just very innocuous cleaning chemicals. She lived a totally normal life, white collar job. She's the boss and she... You know, she lives in a nice part of town. She goes to yoga. She goes to their equivalent of Whole Foods. You know, just a nice kind of upper middle class existence. Upper class, I think. Well, not, on the scale, she's not like a Russian oligarch. She's just like doing well. But one day at work, a bunch of vans pull up and a bunch of FSB agents show up and say they got to take her in, and they start pilfering through things in her office, and she's like, what is this? And she kind of assumes it's got to be some kind of a mistake. And she's not worried. She's genuinely not worried. She's like, I'm not a criminal. Nothing has happened. Sure. Go through whatever file cabinets you want. Everything's fine. She gets picked up. She gets taken to jail, and she's told she's being accused of drug trafficking, which makes no sense to her at all. There's no communication with her about what's happening. And She doesn't get to talk with the outside world. She doesn't get to check in with her husband. She just disappears one day. And she's being kept in this pre-detention facility. Days and days go by. And finally, she learns that what has happened is that she's being accused of selling the exact chemical that her company sells. It's like accusing a plant that makes blue jeans of selling blue jeans. It's like, yeah, that's what she does. She sells this chemical. Mm-hmm. It's licensed. She's licensed to do it, and it's fairly innocuous. It's weird to even call it an accusation. It's not like a secret, but they frame it that way as if she had been like hiding and they had to track her down. And none of that's true at all. And then she just starts spiraling in jail. Months and months go by.
Whoa.
And she's being held here on completely bullshit charges. No one will explain anything to her. She starts making friends with other women in the jail and learns like, quite a lot of people are here for made-up reasons.
Bogus stuff, yeah.
Yeah. So I believe she's held for the better part of a year. I can't remember exactly how long the book, but held for a very long time before anything useful comes to light. Eventually, they find out that the story behind what had actually happened is that she's just being used as a prop and a power play between two competing larger corporations with different connections to the Kremlin. Sort of trying to make an example for small and mid-sized chemical distributors that are going up against some larger company.
So it's like, okay, first question. Mm-hmm. What is the FSB? Is that like the FBI for Russia?
Kind of, except it's kind of like the FBI in terms of how they work, but there's different FSBs for different agencies. So there's like an FSB for, I wish I'd written this down. There's like two different FSB agents involved with this case. And one of them is in like monitoring and managing things like the chemical compounds, like some sort of industrial chemical industry overseer of sorts.
Okay.
And then there's some other FSB person that's a broader corporate overseer. And so there's a bit of a Venn diagram on like where this case overlaps for them.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens in the end is that basically the original FSB agent who kicked all of this off ended up doing so to try to set an example and create a power play for one of his friends who has a competing company. But this other FSB agent, it was going to create some other problem for, and he had stronger connections to the Kremlin. So it just all got shut down, and she just got spit back out like nothing ever happened. So
the human rights violations is insane.
Yeah. She actually started a nonprofit organization to try to help other Russian business owners from having this happen to them, because this is actually an extremely common practice in Russia. It's called raiding. Or in Russia, it's called, oh, wow, I'm really taking a lot of skydives. today. Writer's flow. Writer's flow. Means rating.
That's like if FTC, I guess, was involved in taking down a mom and pop shop that was selling tools in order to help Home Depot.
Basically, yeah. So the way it would work in Russia is that while the people from the smaller mom and pop shop are in jail, they keep them there for a long time, and then the company is given over to like the state, which is then auctioned off. And by the time that the people are let out of jail,
they have nothing,
and the other companies absorb them entirely. So there are over 100 cases of raiding per year in Russia, in which business rivals or bureaucrats pay the head of security services to have their rivals arrested. While they're in prison, their documents and registrations are seized, their company is re-registered under different openers, and by the time the original owner is released, it's split up. It can happen on a large scale, like the Kremlin handing an oil company over to his friends, but it even happens on really small local levels, like police chiefs taking over furniture stores.
I'm just like, there are ways in which this happens in the U.S. and really anywhere in the world, but there's ways in which this happens, but I correct me if I'm wrong, it's not to this scale, and it's not without repercussions or some sort of consequences coming for the entities trying to do it.
Definitely not. I mean, this is way more egregious than anything you'd see in the U.S., but I think it's a good look at, like, when you have hyper-normalization, the sort of, like, everything's built on a fake system.
Yeah.
What the eventuality, like the extreme end of that is. Because I think we're like halfway on that hyper-normalization scale. Mm-hmm. We're like, if you can just be a regular business owner living your life in Russia, you have this foundation in your head that you're living in a society built on laws, and that are the laws are upheld by courts, and there's some kind of basic fairness or some basic structure to the world around you, but there's not. It's a pure illusion. Everything's being controlled by bureaucrats, and every law is flexible. Everything in your life is really just something that you have at the mercy of the bureaucrats, allowing you to have it when you have it.
This is 100% what Trump wants to do.
Yeah, it's what Trump and Elon would love the world to look
like. Like, not even slightly different. It's exactly what they want to do.
Yeah, in a world where corporations have control and banks have control, this is what the world would look like.
I mean, definitely keep going. But
I mean, I don't know if I want to like be alarmist and say that this is where America's heading. But I think in the scale of hypernormalization, it's a good point of context.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have a hard time thinking that America could get to that same point, because of so many factors about what makes up our country. But also, I think one of the key differences, and this is possibly a wild statement I'm about to make, is everybody being strapped up. Everybody's got guns.
Yeah.
And I think that makes a whole different kind of country when that kind of violence is at your fingertips, quite literally.
Yeah, and try to take over a furniture store here.
So the idea of this just becoming normal, it might become normal in some areas, but across a country of 330 million who all have gun rights, I don't see it happening. Some folks are going to be taken out before it gets to that point, I think.
Yeah, I don't think America's going to get there either. And if we did, it would take a pretty long time and require a much more oppressive media system to support it. Which we're not on a great track for openness of our media system. But I think it'd be alarmist to say that I'm pitching this as America's future.
Yeah, I think we'd have a hard time getting there full fledged.
But I think the people in charge love these concepts. So
yeah, they do.
So the usual way out of something like this in Russia would be a bribe. But there's a whole industry for payoffs. You don't need a skillful lawyer to get out, because every verdict is predetermined. Of those charged in Russia, 99% received guilty verdicts. You need a lawyer with a connection to pay off the correct judiciary or relevant ministry. A whole mess of middlemen pop up and try to convince you that they're the one alone who can pay off the right person, and it's very difficult to navigate. Yana, who we've been talking about, their lawyer told her parents that what they needed to do was have Yana admit to the crimes, and then her parents should sell their apartment to pay for a bribe, which would have amounted to about $1 million. In the end, this move with Yana actually turned out to hurt the financial interests of a competing FSB leader, like I said earlier, and it was all just overturned without so much as an apology.
My brain is, I think it's in shock. I think it's in shock with how intensely corrupt this all is. Like, it's one thing to be fed information about how it is in Russia. It's an entirely different thing for you to have done research into things that have happened there and how they've happened, and to say this isn't that uncommon.
That's what's crazy is that, and again, this is what makes it hyper-normalization. I'm not just talking about corruption. I'm talking about a system in which this corruption is known by everyone and accepted to be just part of the way things are. And they have to live a life where they pretend like this isn't the way things are. That's the only way to function as a human. So that's what's crazy. It's like nothing that I've said is like a conspiracy theory or some kind of like thing the Kremlin doesn't want you to know. This is all extremely out there, very open information. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's a very, it's kind of extra scary, this defeatist, I think, philosophy you'd have if you lived in a world where this was happening all the time.
Yeah.
And that's just how things are. How are you going to go up against that as a sole person?
Yeah.
And when all of the collective organizations who are saying things that you can go on the watch, like anti-Putin television programs that are saying how bad this stuff is, but that's controlled by Putin. It's all a show.
Yeah. I'm feeling quite a lot of empathy for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, if you live in Russia, you don't know what way is up.
Yeah. And you, in order to exist in any form that feels somewhat healthy, you have to dissociate.
Yeah, you have to. The world is so surreal that they live in.
Yeah.
It is like avant-garde theater, like Zadislav.
I mean, you'd have to have an incredible amount of people to come up against it and be willing to sacrifice themselves to change it.
Uh-huh.
But with so many people benefiting from it at every level, I don't see how that's possible. It would be different if it was like the people at the very top are the only ones benefiting, which is why I don't think America is necessarily positioned to turn out this way, because it'd be different if it was like this huge gap between the haves and the have-nots. And don't get me wrong, there definitely is in Russia and every parts of the world. But because there's literally people of the have-nots who are also benefiting from the system of it, you have so many people that you have to convince to go against it in order to take out the people at the very, very top who also have the military power, who all these people along the way, the judiciary, the police officers, like, all people you interface with every single day are in on it. How do you dismantle it when that many people are in on it? Versus in the U.S., the folks who don't benefit are vastly larger. The numbers are vastly larger than the people who do. So the push against it is far more possible.
And actually, there's a really good sort of metaphor in that book that I really liked, that he said geographically in Russia, literally every business wants to be as physically close to the Kremlin as possible. And it's sort of like a big circle. Right at the center, you got the Kremlin. And then all of the sort of downtown area around that is all businesses wanting to be like one block closer if they can. Everyone's trying to be as close physically as they can, because that's seen as having more connections. And even, you know, outside of the physical, there's like a big circular power structure. And if you want power, being closer to the Kremlin puts you within that power structure. And that's what we saw with those competing FSB agents.
Mm-hmm.
One was just a little bit closer to the Kremlin, and then he got his way. And it's all just like a complicated web of who knows who and who's closer to the top power player.
Wow.
It was interesting.
Yeah.
Scary, but interesting. Well, I'm going to take us out of Mother Russia and into the US of A. Good old America. Hot dogs, hamburgers, barbecue. We got other stuff too.
Fireworks.
The Grand Canyon. I'm going to put an eagle sound here. Now, I think that illustration of how things work in Russia is illuminating for what our future could look like potentially, or at least sort of a good framework for the broader conversation about hypernormalization. But there are certainly examples to which this is already in America. And I think the best demonstration of this is with the concept of perception management. You ever heard that term, perception management? Sounds very conspiratorial.
No, but it feels very clear.
Yeah, so this is a term that came out under the Reagan administration.
Of course.
Perception management is, say, I'm quoting from Consortium News, who I thought had a good definition. Propaganda in pursuit of foreign policy goals, which would trump the democratic ideal of an informed electorate. So the point would be not to honestly inform the American people about events around the world, but to manage their perceptions by either ramping up fears in some cases or diffusing outrage in others.
Yep.
So the Reagan administration did this for the Vietnam War, strategically denying some information or exposing other information in order to understate protests or protect their interests as it related to Vietnam. There's a whole slew of other examples we can get into.
But see, the reaction to the Vietnam War is exactly my point about the difference in how the information is handled. Uh-huh. The huge national backlash against that war proves that whatever he was trying to shape as far as perception was not working and would not work.
Yeah.
There was a huge distrust by that point. And I that's why I think the peak of what they could have achieved in hypernormalization was in the 50s. And it was always meant to crumble simply based on one, how the country was founded with on the premise of lies, right?
Yeah.
And then two, what they did after the Civil War. Uh-huh. All of these things set them up for not having an electorate that was going to follow blindly.
Yeah.
Droves, you know what I mean? Like, they were never going to be able to deny the history of the country enough to allow for just a resignation of this is just what it is.
You know, also, I wasn't thinking about this when I was writing it, but you saying that kind of made me think. I'm often a little defeatist about protesting. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it feels like people are just like getting stuff out of their system and not really affecting anything directly. But I think in a world where we're being told what the public sentiment is, I think protests are more important than ever just to reset that narrative. Be like, oh, look, a million people think this way.
Yeah.
And they're out in the streets, even if you're not directly affecting change in the way that maybe some people marching think that they are. You are creating your own narrative of what you support in a way that can't be skewed.
Yeah. Protest is a crucial, like outward protest, yelling, angry, marching is a crucial piece of what is required to dismantle oppressive powers. Uh-huh. That's just the way it is. I am not a fan of just angry marching without there being some other act attached to it, because angry marching won't do anything.
Yeah.
It's angry marching in pursuit of what would be deemed as an inappropriate or illegal act. That's what makes protests effective. Like when you think about the civil rights movement, they went to do something illegal, which was sit into a whites-only diner.
Yeah.
So the protest was attached to something that was then illegal that shouldn't be illegal.
Uh-huh.
And we have a harder time with that now because there's a lot of self-preservation, and I get that. But the first step of shaping the narrative, angrily screaming, no, 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 if nothing else, it shows the people who are watching, oh, so it's not just me.
Yeah.
Let me get involved. Let me go do this. So slowly but surely, you start to get more and more people who are like, yeah, I don't agree with this. I don't feel like they're going in the right direction. How do I get involved with these people who are bold and loud about what they don't agree with? How do I get involved with them in the way that's comfortable for me or whatever that looks like? But it's definitely an important piece. That's not the piece that I'm into,
yeah,
but it's definitely an important piece.
But I think that's such a good way of putting that, because especially as as far as like the tenet of gaslighting goes and hypernormalization, there's a lot of people out there. I imagine everyone listening to this has experienced this under Trump's presidencies, where you feel like you're nuts and you're like, things seem so much worse than what I feel like people are saying they are. And am I crazy for thinking that it's that bad? And it's like, no, you're not crazy. You're just in a media ecosystem that's not quite grasping it all together. And by going out there, you are showing other people what you think, and they're not alone. And that has its own importance. So,
yeah.
So, let's see. Vietnam War, Adam Curtis.
Reagan the devil.
Reagan. You gotta love him. The Gipper! We love the Gipper. You know what he loved? Jelly beans. Did you know that? Did you know that? He loved jelly beans.
I wish he would have choked on one.
I know. Also, I went to the Reagan National Library. There's a bit of a side story now. I went to the Reagan National Library, and I didn't know about his jelly beans thing. They were all over the place. And I just imagine that... you could buy Reagan jelly beans in the gift shop, and they were all over the fucking museum. So I just imagine, like, they were going, like, okay, you know, you're a charismatic actor, but is there, like, something quirky? Do you ride a unicycle or anything? And he's like,
I love jelly beans.
Yeah, jelly beans are okay. Kind of flavorless, cheap sugar shit.
Do you even know what a jelly bean is?
I have a jelly bean farm. Am I going to have to divest from my jelly bean farm?
You don't even know what a jelly bean is.
He didn't sound like that at all. He's from California.
He didn't sound like that at all. But that's what I think of when I hear jelly beans. Little what? Jack from the South.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Ooh, is that made with real jelly? Yeah. I just felt fake to me. I was like, I bet in real life he's like, oh, I hate these fucking jelly beans.
No. He liked the jelly beans. I'm convinced he liked the jelly beans. I'm just as much as we know that Trump loves McDonald's and wants to only eat that. Like,
oh, I like that comparison. Maybe.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. He liked jelly beans.
Anyways, that was a fun visit. I got to see the Ronald Reagan hologram. It was a great time. Back to it.
What an aside.
So... in that Adam Curtis documentary I keep citing, it's kind of the central reference point for this whole episode. He talks a lot about perception management, and he uses as his primary, kind of the primary narrative for the whole documentary, is America's narratives around Muammar Gaddafi.
Okay, here we go.
Yeah. So
I'm strapped in.
Getting into old Muammar. That crazy little rascal we like to call Muammar Gaddafi. So after humiliating defeats in Lebanon, the Reagan administration was desperate to create a vision of a moral world in which a good America struggled against evil. Like that first tenet I told you about, simplistic narratives around good guy versus bad guy. Because we get that. We've seen Westerns. We know how it works. Good guy, bad guy. To do this, they needed a simple villain, an imaginary enemy, one that would be free from the paralyzing complexity of real Middle Eastern politics. The perfect candidate was waiting in the wings. Colonel Gaddafi, the ruler of Libya. The Americans were going to ruthlessly use Colonel Gaddafi to create a fake terrorist mastermind. And Gaddafi was going to happily play along because it would just turn him into a famous global figure.
Mm-hmm.
Gaddafi had taken power in a coup in the 1970s, but from the very start, he was convinced that he was an international revolutionary whose destiny was to challenge the power of the West. He had this whole philosophical concept called the Third Way, and it was kind of dumb and very boring, and he was very obsessed with it and would talk about it any chance he could get. But he really didn't have any power, and by the 1980s, he didn't have really any connection with other Arab leaders. They thought he was insane and a weirdo, and he just became an isolated figure with no friends or no global influence. Just kind of a guy who talked real big.
Oh, sounds like Trump.
He's a lot like Trump. In fact, there's a lot of good interplay between him and Trump in the documentary. Trump sold him like a building or something. Anyway, this is too big of a side story. But in 1985, terrorists attacked Rome and Vienna airports simultaneously, killing 19 people, five of which were Americans. Urged to retaliate, Reagan decided to pin this whole thing on Gaddafi.
Mm-hmm.
European security services who investigated the attacks said there's no way that Libya was involved, and they're pretty certain that the attack was from a group that was being directed by the Syrian intelligence agencies. But America has interest in Syria, and they don't have interest in Libya. So without any evidence pointing to Gaddafi, and Gaddafi being happy to play along as his big sort of egomaniacal figure that he loved to play as, he now had the ear of the world to make all of his unhinged proclamations and ambitions, from space exploration to attacking America. He had a bunch of big ideas, and it was very easy to pen him as this evil mastermind or someone who wanted to create chaos in the world. But he's just some guy who talks real big. America and Gaddafi became locked together in a cycle of mutual reinforcement. Gaddafi became a global supervillain in the eyes of the world and a madman who threatened the stability of the world. And Gaddafi was loving every minute of it. America, unable to confront the risks that would come from attacking Libya, propped up this powerless maniac to fulfill a simplistic narrative that shied away from messy realities. Years later, Iraq was imploding during the George Bush administration, George W. Bush, and they desperately needed to show that the invasion they were doing was actually having a positive effect on the Arab world, because the war wasn't looking so good. Mm-hmm. People were starting to become disillusioned with the original intentions of the invasions. So they made an extraordinary decision. They turned for the help of the man they had always insisted was the world's most dangerous tyrant, Gaddafi. And instead, they set out to make him their new best friend. It was going to be the highest achievement of perception management. A man who had been created by the West as a fake global supervillain was now going to be turned into a fake hero of democracy. And everyone, not just politicians, became involved. Public relations, academics, television presenters, spies, and even musicians were all going to help reinvent Gaddafi's image. It was going to show how many people in the Western establishment had, by now, become the engineers of this fake world. Ever since he had been accused of the Lockerbie bombing, Colonel Gaddafi had been a complete outcast. But the West imposed sanctions on Libya. After the West imposed sanctions on Libya, their economy was falling apart. But Tony Blair got out there and said that Gaddafi was going to dismantle his nuclear arms program, and that this was like a big change in his willingness for democracy and peace. But in reality, Gaddafi didn't have a nuclear arms program. He didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. But Gaddafi said he did, and then said he was dismantling them, because that got him invited to the UN, and he got to speak for 2 hours in front of the UN, which was a first. I think no Libyan leader had ever been invited to speak at the UN before. And Tony Blair said, in a pretty gross little quote here, that Gaddafi is welcoming his society back to the community of civilized nations.
Wow.
Yeah. So they, you know, made him out to be this like cartoonish supervillain. As soon as it became advantageous, said, actually, he's turned a new leaf and he's the greatest guy. But then uprisings in Libya happened. Arab Spring, I think is what it was called. It was across the Middle East, but that ended up just switching their objectives again. They just turned right back around and said, actually, he is a supervillain. And they just kept turning these things on and off like a faucet for some soap opera storylines when the narratives or public perceptions needed to shift at their will. And all the meanwhile, he's just some guy who will say whatever they want him to say. And he's really no threat to anybody.
I mean, this feels like any other perception manipulation that people do in their everyday lives, in that at the time of George W. Bush's presidency, it was 9/11, the perfect time for us to get behind what we perceive as a supervillain. When that tragedy happened, we only wanted retaliation. We only wanted an answer for this, and willing to look at anybody as the reason for it. Uh-huh. But at the same time, and once again, why I keep saying I don't necessarily think hypernormalization is the future of America, at the same time that was happening, there was already distrust in how the United States destabilizes other countries around the world. Like, in the same breath as mourning 9/11 was blaming America for the reason 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
So you had both viewpoints, and those two things exist even in the same person's mind. Like, oh my God, this is so horrifying. This is so tragic. But America did this. America is the reason people would want to do something like this. So in that way, I don't necessarily think that, again, I keep emphasizing this. I don't know that we have that in our fate.
Though I think a lot of that narrative became more prominent in retrospect. Like, at the time, I mean, you know, at this time, I was a kid, you know, during the George W. Bush administration. I wasn't politically engaged, but I remember seeing these very straightforward good guy, bad guy narratives. And there was this kind of idea that if we go over there and we invade and we just take the bad guys out, then democracy will just naturally come back in. And it's just kind of this dumb, naive.
I think this is where we need to like very clearly state our very different experiences of narratives that happened in the U.S., right?
Okay.
So you are from Texas.
Uh-huh.
I'm from Washington, D.C.
Okay, that is...
very different ecosystems where there is a ingrained understanding of the things that happen in the country. The lifeblood of that area is government.
You and D.C. may not represent the broader American
interpretation. No, I get what you're saying. But I'm saying in more liberal states, the narrative by far was both.
Yeah. You think
it was an understanding that this is horrifying. We definitely should do something about this. But also, America has been making enemies for however long. Those two thoughts came together, though the second thought wasn't spoken out loud because it was a time of patriotism. And that's even true in Washington, D.C. The Pentagon was hit. Like, it was super true in Washington, D.C., but it was also, God damn it, like, we had it coming. And now let's fight, though. Let's fight because this thing is not whatever. And that those two thoughts were the prevailing thought in liberal states, liberal spaces, and also just generally in the Black community. Those thoughts are never separate from each other.
That's a good point.
You know what I mean? Like, there's always, this is horrifying, this thing that has happened to America and that we're going to have to endure this. But also, America is absolute garbage to a huge amount of the world, including their own citizens. So it's like you never get to separate these two things. Yeah.
Good point. Definitely from my perspective as a white kid, also a child, which is a part of it too. Maybe I wasn't
also
watching.
I'm older than you.
Yeah. As a white child in Christian Texas, I definitely 100% thought America are the good guys and we're only doing good guy stuff. And the idea that we had it coming, probably not something I even really considered until much, much later.
I remember us literally standing on a bridge looking at the smoke from the Pentagon, neighborhood friends, and being like, guys, we're going to war.
Yeah.
Like, we knew that immediately. Like, we're going to war. And there's people who hate us, hate Americans. Uh-huh. And let's just hope they don't try to get the regular folks anymore.
Well, I think if there's one good takeaway from this Gaddafi framing, it's that you should always be skeptical of any simplistic narrative, especially when it just frames us as John Wayne.
Mm-hmm. Especially. You know? I mean, every country does
We're just rolling into being good guys. I mean, I think people are more skeptical of that now, but it's a broader perspective, not just in terms of our relationship with Middle East and things. Simplification of narrative, simplification, creating personalities is very prominent. And it's like everyone at every space of creating narratives is involved with that.
And I will say too, like during this period in the Bush administration, second Bush, we wanted someone to give us a narrative. I think that's also a part of maybe, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong. I feel like that's probably a key part of hypernormalization. When you feel out of control, when something has jolted your sense of control, you want a narrative.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's too big of an event for you to create a narrative for yourself. So I think we wanted that. We wanted a narrative. We wanted to believe there was weapons of mass destruction because what else could this have been for them to do such a thing? And so when I think about the Yana woman, it's like the people where that's happening, where there is no hope that you can change this thing.
Uh-huh.
It's like, I have to create a narrative. I can't change this. There's nowhere I can go. I have to create some narrative for myself in a small way to be able to exist in this ecosystem.
That couldn't have possibly been a better segue for where I wanted to take us.
Okay.
Creating your own narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Because now I want to just give us a big open water discussion about how we see this in different American factions. And I think QAnon is that. It is people who see these artificial narratives and then they are completely incorrectly reacting to it by creating their own artificial narratives that keep them as the protagonists and as the good guys because they're not willing to admit these more problematic complexities.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like QAnon's a weird example of people hyper-normalizing themselves.
And this is how truly messed up our country is right now. I completely forgot about QAnon.
Well, it's not.
So many things have happened that I completely forgot that that was such an intense.
Yeah. I mean, it's not really like a direct thing anymore. There aren't still Q drops, or at least there's not still people following Q drops. But all of that has just permeated. That is the Republican Party, is that thinking. And I think that's sort of like, I mean, it's what I already said, but that style of thinking is just sort of like, what is a made-up narrative that I can come up with that helps me compartmentalize all of the chaos that I don't want to sort through?
Yeah. I don't know what's worse, like doing that or completely dissociating where you pretend it's just not happening.
Yeah, neither is fun.
Because pretending it's just not happening is just like, so you're just going to wait for it to come to your doorstep.
Yeah. So the QAnon people are actively helping the bad narratives.
Yeah.
They're just like, they're yes anding. It's like improv.
They are yes anding. Wow. Wow. I completely forgot about QAnon. But that, you're right. It's the frame of thinking.
I mean,
it's the frame of thinking. And it's Trump's trademark, that kind of thinking.
Yeah.
Because he himself just completely latches on to whatever's out there.
Yeah. And it's what I've been saying to my fellow left-leaning friends for like a decade now. They always look at the things people on the right are saying. They're like, how can they think that? It's so like easy to disprove. It's so easy to debunk. And I think the thing that a lot of people, I think they're coming around to now, but took us a long time to get around to, is that a lot of their beliefs are in bad faith. They don't actually believe that. It's the hyper-normalization. They know they're being lied to. People lying know that the people they're lying to know they're being lied to. And they're all going along with it because it in some way solidifies an emotion or a narrative that they've bought into. And that's why you can't argue with them. You can't debunk anything because their arguments are not tied to a complex examination of the interplays of their lives and of the world events. It's just tied to, I mean, I guess emotion, but yeah, it's bad faith. It's hyper-normalization. It's just, they know it's a lie. They're not saying they know it's a lie. They're doing kayfabe. They're playing along.
So I never gave them as much credit as I feel that you're doing right now, but you're right. You're right. Like a lot of them do know that they're being lied to and they just need something as like almost like a coping mechanism. But I do think that there are people who know they're being lied to, don't care, and are using it to their advantage. And that's what I consider the Candace Owens of the world.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm talking more about the general average populace,
yeah,
than the influencers. Yeah, no, I think the Candace Owens of the world 100% know what they're doing. They're grifters,
yeah,
who are exploiting people. But I think it's not everybody, but I think a large portion of like the Trump base, they're not going to admit to themselves that everything is a lie, but they know that everything's a lie. That's why they're impossible to talk to.
Yeah. You're exposing my frame of thought here quite a bit because I truly just assume them to be idiots who really did believe. And maybe that was my own hyper-normalization, where it's like, that's an easier narrative than to think that people know that they're being lied to, but still create a narrative around that and accept it and pretend to accept it. Because I have a hard time with that kind of thinking. I have people in my family who do that in varying degrees, not necessarily about politics, but just by certain life difficulties. Like, you know that this thing is happening, but you're choosing not to deal with it at all and operate in a way that suggests that you really don't think it's happening.
Yeah.
So you saying it that way kind of shifted my perspective that it truly is a coping mechanism. So with that, my question is, what happens when they no longer have that coping mechanism? It feels like when you have a drug addict that can no longer get their fix, then what?
Yeah, I don't know. They crash out. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of been my shred of hope for
that they all crash out.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the only way. I think it's like, how far can you keep lying to yourself before you just don't have any tether anymore? And then you just don't know how to navigate anything.
Yeah. This is, it may feel like a reach, but it literally is what is in my brain as we're talking about this. So there was this event, this astrological event at some point during slavery in America. Hmm. There was this astrological event. It was like a meteor shower, and owners thought the world was ending. Like, they were praying to everything that they could pray to. They were asking for forgiveness because they were owners and they felt sorry that they did this thing, this horrible thing. They were repenting and all these different things. And then the enslaved were like, oh my God, they're actually really sorry. I think after this is over, we're actually going to be free.
Yes.
100% did not happen. They completely said, oh, just kidding. Just kidding.
Yeah.
We crashed out for a second, but we're back. Everything's fine. It was false.
That is that's a perfect example.
Yeah.
That's a perfect example. Because that's why I always bristle when people refer to anything as like, that was the times. I'm like, I think people always knew better.
Yeah.
Especially with slavery. But they knew better. They knew better. And they're choosing a narrative to not know better because it benefits them to follow that narrative. But they do know better.
They do know better. There's endless, not endless, I'm exaggerating. There's so many letters of the founding fathers that knew better.
Yeah.
Quite literally, the founding fathers knew better. Their letters to each other on their deathbeds that saying, we have ruined things for our children. Thomas Jefferson was inconsolable that his grandchildren were violent toward one of the enslaved people on the plantation because he was never violent in that way.
Right. He had his own.
Yeah. And ethics. So he's like, he couldn't believe that he saw through his own family that the original sin was now being yes-anded by his own grandchildren. He was like inconsolable forever. He went to a depression. He wrote letters to, like, I don't know, John Adams or somebody. And he's just like, oh, what have we done? What have we done? They always knew better. They always, always, always knew better. In fact, they had an entire mother country, UK, that showed them better. And they still chose not to do better. In fact, during the founding, there were so many factions of parts of the U.S. that did not want it.
Yeah.
Did not want it at all. But the overwhelming majority would get in there. So anyway.
That is such a good point that I had not thought about. You're right. Like, living as a slave owner has huge implications with hypernormalization.
Oh, huge. And so the layers of hypernormalization are insane when you really think about that.
Yeah.
Not just as insane, but like when I think about what you talked about with Russia, all the different layers of hypernormalization that exist, I see the parallels of the period of enslavement where you had to have every single person who was involved in the enterprise along the way accepting this as the reality, even as all these horrifying, and I mean horrifying, things were happening along the way.
Yeah.
But there was too many people to benefit. So it makes me wonder, not that there's any studies on this, it makes me wonder what hypernormalization had to exist in the enslaved minds. I think about that.
Yeah,
that
that too.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Like, for sure.
In order to survive that, you had to.
Yeah.
You had to. Like, how else would you? You simply end yourself or do something to be ended.
Yeah, you can't just like actively live in this surreal environment. You have to normalize it in your head.
And they didn't. They revolted constantly, like constant rebellion.
Yeah.
Again, I think I said this in the earlier part of the episode. America has, since the founding and after the Civil War, has not set themselves up for widespread, like countrywide hypernormalization because the country was set up in such a dichotomy that, like, you have way too many people who see you for the bullshit you are to accept it. And I, we could be very wrong. Maybe the doom
is... Republicans are trying to rewrite history, so
yeah,
quite literally.
They are quite literally deleting things on like Monday or something like that.
Ugh.
Like historical documents.
Yeah?
Yeah.
They're going to burn up the Constitution, but flip it over and put lemon it's juice like on the... it, see if there's a treasure map there first, just in case.
The burning of, it's like the burning of the library in Alexandria. They're trying to do something similar.
Yeah. That's not fun.
No.
Well, your astrological event example also made me think of another little historical story. Once upon a time, a bunch of Congress people were saying that an election was stolen. And then one day, a bunch of crazy fuckheads broke in with zip ties, face masks, wanting to kill those Congress people. And they said, oh, no. They went and they hid. And then when all the dust settled, they came back out and said, that was bad. Hey, that was wrong. Actually, we should turn the tide. And then a few days later, they went, oh, just kidding. Back to saying the election was stolen. Remember when they were scared for their lives for like a minute?
I'm getting so angry.
Where McConnell and Lindsey Graham coming out there and being like, whoa, hey, okay. Maybe we went too far.
Which is what pisses me off about how the Republican Party is backing everything now. Because like these people didn't care about you. Like they tried to break in and kill you.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, physically harm you.
All they care about is where their bread is buttered. And that's it. Okay, so I wanted to do a light closeout on our episode with, I thought, a perspective that was kind of interesting in the Adam Curtis documentary. He talks briefly about the Occupy Wall Street movement. And I think his sort of thesis on it is that it's interesting how, like, how much momentum it had and how, like, effective and innovative they were in organizing and in creating a real ecosystem for the protesters to like set up. They had, you know, food, they had medics, they had, they called it the human microphone, where you got so many people and they echo and they repeat for people that are further in the back. And it's like they had this big infrastructure and they had correctly identified a massive issue that required change, but they did not present an alternative. They did not present a way forward. They didn't have a vision for how to change. And so it just dissipated. And I think that's a good lesson for how we should look at our movements going forward, is that it's not enough just to be angry. It's not enough just to be organized or to donate our time. We need to have a clear and concise vision.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something the Democratic Party is not offering people. They have zero vision for how America could be different. All they say is, things are bad. Please donate to my fund.
Yeah.
But we need a clear and concise vision for what's going forward. And I'm not going to try to start a giant spiral here on what those visions could be. But I think that's an important perspective, that breaking out of hypernormalization is not just recognizing the structures, but also presenting a concise objective.
Yeah.
An actionable objective and a vision for a future that can be an alternative. Because that's why people get stuck in hypernormalization, is that they don't have an alternative. So they just get stuck.
I have a potentially controversial viewpoint.
Go for it.
So during this past election cycle, there was a splinter in the Democratic voter base.
Uh-huh.
Muslim Americans, Palestinians, allies of Gaza and the Palestinians, versus people who wanted to deal with that, but by getting Kamala Harris in and not understanding why pro-Palestinians didn't think she was the right person and would not vote for her. I think that splinter jogged the left and left-leaning out of their hypernormalization, or it challenged some form of hypernormalization that the left had, that this system can be worked with, because the Palestinian supporters were saying it can't be. It cannot be worked with.
Yeah.
And there was this intense clash between these two that said that didn't result in anything good for either of them, but that it maybe potentially was a good thing to jolt those people who were gung-ho about the system as it is, like we could work within it. Maybe it jolted them out of their own form of hypernormalization.
Yeah.
That the Democrats are also lying to us. The Democrats are also not good at what they're doing. The Democrats are also doing a lot that's wrong.
Yeah.
And that simply giving them our vote and being pacified that they're just not as bad as the right isn't enough anymore. And I think in a lot of ways, the pro-Palestinian movement exposed that in the left. And hopefully it has reformed the left in a way that we can move forward. That may be a controversial way to look at it, because
I don't think it's that controversial. Okay. I think a lot of people are coming to that conclusion. I 100% agree. Mm-hmm. I think if before this last election you had trouble discerning the difference between the term liberal and leftist, now everybody knows the difference between liberal and leftist.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that while the effects are wildly different, the interests behind the narratives presented by the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are much the same.
Mm-hmm.
That they're creating simplified narratives that ultimately benefit corporate donors, lobbyists, banks. Any narrative that they push is not going to be at the detriment of those interests.
Yeah.
And leftists is not tied to those interests. And I think liberalism is very much tied to maintaining those systems.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of things that were done wrong with mm-hmm. Kamala's campaign, presenting no message at all. And just being like, actually, I'm a little right wing was basically her message.
but we have the most
lethal military in the world. I'll make it more lethal. Okay.
But I think that's the liberal reality that
it is. The liberal
folks
reality.
Had to be jolted out of.
Yeah, the liberal reality is like, actually, the status quo is not bad. Actually, and even though it seems like unemployment is bad, it's even though it seems like prices are high, actually, if you look at the statistics, they're not. And people aren't vibing with that. They could see this reality around them as not lining up to just being mm-hmm. told everything's okay.
Yeah.
That's basically their whole narrative, which is like, actually, everything is fine. We can fix a couple of things, but actually, things are better than you think that they are.
Yeah. Okay. Possibly another... As you're saying this, I'm like...
The last one wasn't that controversial. The last one, I think.
Well, this one it might be. The leftists are a bit like MAGA in that way, where they completely want to subvert from whatever the idea of the party is because it's not working. The leftists are not insane, in, you know?
Yeah.
They still are grounded in... the reality of what the world could be from a much more benevolent, much less controlling standpoint, more egalitarian standpoint. But they're two very similar motivations on completely opposite ends of the spectrum, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
MAGA doesn't like the Republicans either. They don't like the system either. That's why they want it torn down. The leftists don't like the system. They also want to tear it down, but they want to tear it down and replace it with egalitarian ways of thinking. The MAGA wants to tear it down to what end?
Well, you know what? I think that a big difference between those two extremes is that I think leftists see through the bullshit in a different way, where mm-hmm. I think like Republicans see that what they're being presented is bullshit. But then they just like double down on the shit they're being presented. Whereas leftists see that what they're being presented is bullshit, but they do actually have a vision for how to change. And I think that their interests are largely the same. I think if you take away all of the like culture war, identity, horse shit, all of the like tribalism, all of the cult shit, actually 80% of America would be down for so many of the same leftist policies.
Yeah. But unfortunately, I think the identity of white America is so powerful in the minds of constituents that is a tenet that I don't believe we'll see let go. It's very, very difficult to let power go.
I mean, that's been a war we've had in America since its inception. So
yeah,
not getting too excited about getting... being subverted all of a sudden soon.
Yeah.
But
I think I do think you're right in that the leftists are like, but I want to steadily move toward that end. And that is terrifying to the other side.
Yeah.
Because what does that mean? Where am I in that story? I'm no longer on top in that story.
Yeah.
And they're not on top now. That's the thing. Like, you're disenfranchised just like everyone else. It's a class issue, not a color issue, not an ethnic issue. It's just, it's so silly. But man, now I'm using in my mind, I'm interpreting hypernormalization as like this really intense accepted delusion that each person has to varying degrees. And that there's huge chunks of society that also participate in a collective delusion. At what point do you think it becomes reality where you no longer feel like you are actively participating, but that this has become real for you?
I mean, that's Russia. Russia is the example of that. You know, with the fall of the USSR, it took time until some generations passed, and that just became the world. I think people accept the reality that's presented to them. And when a lot of that reality is controlled by, well, in Russia, a consolidated media force, that becomes the reality. Whereas at least in the US, it's not equal to everyone's degree, but we do have different voices in different places. And we've got new media where we've got people, YouTube and Twitch. And, you know, I like to lean to, for investigative journalism, actual organizations that can do that firsthand work.
Yeah.
But I think there's so much good work being done in terms of like discourse and leftist takes in these other platforms. And you have to take it all in. Mm-hmm. There's, I have to look it up. I can't remember the statistic, but I saw some statistic a long time ago that said like 65% of Republicans, when surveyed, said they get the majority of their news from a single source.
Yeah.
And that number for on the left was like 15% or something, way lower. I would say because so much about hyper-normalization is about accepting the narratives that are presented to you. And I hate saying it like that. It makes me sound like a right-wing conspiracy guy. I'm not saying do your own research. I'm saying diversify your media intake. I'm not saying you're looking for things that validate your emotions or validate your preconceptions. To the very opposite.
Yeah.
Diversify. Look at the weird right-wing shit. Look at the really corporate MSNBC bullshit. Then also look at personalities that have diverse takes. You just need to be able to take in as much diverse information as you can, because that's, I think, the only counter to living under a hyper-normalized accepted state.
Yeah. Makes me think of what we've talked about in the past about the lack of creativity on the right. And that coming from or being rooted in a lack of curiosity. If you're a single source person, you are absolutely not curious about anything.
Absolutely.
And so how that shows up in your art, back to Surkoff, how that shows up in your art lacks imagination. It's just this brute force control.
Yeah. Absolutely. I sent you, what's his name? Maybe I'll do this as a pickup because I forget his name. This guy, big New York Times reporter or something, recently said a quote that I loved. He said that the opposite of doom is curiosity.
Mm.
And I said, my God, if that shouldn't have been the tagline for this podcast.
Yeah, you did send that to me.
Yeah, that is like exactly the ethos we're shooting for here, which is just like, be curious, look into things, be curious.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe that's my major takeaway, really, is just be curious, be thoughtful. Be aware, and the sort of learning about hypernormalization is just a thread in that. Now you've got a new philosophical concept in your arsenal that you can use as a point of reference.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
There you go.
All right, well, that's it.
That was great.
Did it work? I wasn't sure if that episode was going to work.
A little existential spiral.
Pretty existential.
Good stuff, yeah. Collectively accepted delusion.
Yeah.
Hypernormalization.
So that's the episode. Thanks very much for everyone for being hyper listening-ization. We're going to cut that joke out. Be sure to follow us everywhere at Happy Doomsday Pod, except for Twitter. And until next time, Happy Doomsday.
Happy Doomsday.